David Graeber's bullshit jobs began as an accidental sensation. In 2013, his essay exploring whether many jobs are actually useless went viral globally, translated into dozens of languages, and even appearing as guerrilla posters throughout the London Underground. What started as speculation was soon confirmed by polling data. 37% to 40% of workers in developed countries believe their jobs make no meaningful contribution to the world. This revelation struck a nerve in our culture precisely because it contradicts everything we're taught about capitalism's efficiency. The book became a cultural touchstone cited by everyone from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to late-night comedians and sparked a global conversation about work's purpose in modern society. Perhaps most remarkably, Graeber's analysis transcended traditional political divides, resonating with both progressives concerned about worker alienation and conservatives frustrated by bureaucratic bloat. What exactly constitutes a bullshit job? Graeber defines it as a form of paid employment that is so completely pointless, unnecessary, or pernicious that even the employee cannot justify its existence, even though, as part of the conditions of employment, the employee feels obliged to pretend that this is not the case. This definition encompasses roles ranging from middle management positions, where people primarily attend meetings about other meetings, to corporate lawyers, whose main function is helping other corporations navigate unnecessarily complex regulations. The key insight is that these jobs aren't necessarily difficult or unpleasant. Many are quite comfortable and well-paid. What makes them bullshit is their fundamental pointlessness, which the workers themselves recognize. This creates a profound psychological violence as people spend their lives performing tasks they secretly believe contribute nothing or even cause harm. For instance, a strategic consultant might earn six figures creating PowerPoint presentations that everyone knows will never be implemented. Or a corporate communications specialist might spend days crafting internal newsletters that no one reads. Crucially, bullshit jobs differ from merely unpleasant shit jobs. A janitor or nurse might work in difficult conditions for low pay, but their work serves an obvious social purpose. The bullshit job phenomenon is something else entirely. Often white-collar positions with good compensation but no discernible benefit to society. Consider the contrast between a garbage collector, whose absence would be immediately felt by society, and a brand compliance officer, whose role could vanish without any impact on organizational function. This contradicts basic economic theory. In capitalism, profit-seeking companies shouldn't waste money on unnecessary employees. Yet somehow, while corporations ruthlessly downsize productive workers who make, maintain, or transport things, the ranks of administrators, consultants, and coordinators continue to swell. For example, while manufacturing jobs have steadily declined, the number of management positions has tripled since the 1950s. Many organizations now have more supervisors than actual workers producing anything tangible. This isn't a simple economic phenomenon, but a moral and political one, reflecting deeper cultural values about work itself. The proliferation of bullshit jobs reveals a society that values the appearance of productivity over actual productivity and associates white-collar work with social status regardless of its utility. This has led to the creation of entire industries built around moving paper from one desk to another, generating reports that no one reads, and holding meetings to plan future meetings, all while maintaining the facade of importance and necessity. The psychological toll on workers trapped in these roles is significant. Many report feelings of depression, anxiety, and loss of self-worth, knowing their work serves no purpose beyond maintaining bureaucratic appearances. Yet they must maintain the pretense that their jobs matter, creating a cognitive dissonance that affects their mental health and overall life satisfaction. Through analyzing hundreds of firsthand testimonials, Graeber identified five major categories of bullshit jobs. flunkies exist primarily to make someone else look or feel important. Like medieval lords who required retinues of servants to maintain status, modern executives maintain unnecessary subordinates as symbols of importance. Ophelia, a portfolio coordinator, admits she has no idea what her title means and spends her days frantically completing both necessary tasks and completely invented responsibilities while executives sit bored. Goons are employees whose jobs have an aggressive element but exist only because other organizations employ them too. Corporate lawyers, telemarketers, PR specialists, and lobbyists often fall into this category. Their work would be unnecessary in a different system. As one tax litigator confessed, "I am a corporate lawyer. I contribute nothing to this world and I'm utterly miserable all of the time." Duct tapers exist to fix problems that shouldn't exist in the first place. Rather than addressing underlying system failures, organizations hire people to manage the consequences. Examples include programmers writing code to make incompatible systems work together, or assistants who spend their days correcting their boss's terrible writing. Historically, this has often been women's work, the emotional labor of smoothing over problems created by oblivious men. Box tickers allow organizations to claim they're doing something they aren't actually doing. Like Betsy, hired to coordinate leisure activities in a care home, but who spent most of her time filling out forms about residents' preferences that were promptly forgotten. The cruel irony is that box tickers often realize their paperwork actively undermines their ostensible purpose by diverting time from meaningful work. Taskmasters come in two varieties: unnecessary supervisors who oversee people who don't need supervision, and those who create bullshit tasks for others. Chloe, an academic dean, exemplifies this type. With no actual budget authority, her job consisted entirely of producing strategy documents that repackaged existing university policies while forcing staff to help with this bullshit proliferation. Many jobs blend multiple types or defy easy classification. Some workers serve as flack catchers, subordinates hired to receive complaints but given no authority to address them. Others become caught in second-order bullshit jobs, positions that would be meaningful if they weren't supporting bullshit enterprises. Why is having a pointless job so profoundly miserable? This seems counterintuitive. Shouldn't people be happy to receive good pay for little effort? Yet the testimonies Graeber collected reveal deep unhappiness, often leading to anxiety, depression, and physical ailments like chronic fatigue, insomnia, and stress-related disorders. The explanation lies in fundamental human psychology. Humans naturally desire to have meaningful impacts on their world, what psychologist Carl Gross called the pleasure at being the cause. This drive appears in infants as young as 6 months, who delight in discovering they can affect their environment. When denied the ability to meaningfully affect our surroundings, we experience what psychiatrist Francis Brusek called the trauma of failed influence, potentially leading to severe mental health issues, including depression, anxiety, and a profound sense of worthlessness. Eric's story perfectly illustrates this dynamic. Hired as an interface administrator for a design firm despite having no IT experience, he found himself with virtually nothing to do. He began arriving late, drinking at lunch, reading novels at his desk, and taking three-hour walks. When he tried to quit, they raised his salary from $65,000 to $80,000. His rebellion escalated to showing up drunk and taking fake business trips, during which he'd party in other cities on company money. Despite these flagrant violations, they wouldn't fire him, highlighting the absurdity of his position. Eventually, after a breakdown at a train station where he found himself sobbing uncontrollably, he managed to resign and fled to Morocco to escape the psychological prison of meaningless employment. What's remarkable is that many would consider Eric's a dream job, good pay for doing nothing with minimal supervision. Yet it gradually destroyed him because he couldn't construe his work as serving any purpose. Similar stories emerged from corporate lawyers, consultants, and middle managers who earned six-figure salaries but felt their work contributed nothing to society. The spiritual violence of modern work emerges from a historical clash between natural work rhythms and imposed time discipline. Traditional societies measured time through activities, rather than measuring activities through abstract time. A farmer's day was marked by tasks like feeding animals or harvesting, not by clock hours. The modern concept that time is money would have bewildered people in most societies throughout history. Ancient Greeks or Romans could understand buying a potter's pots or even buying the potter as a slave, but they'd find it mystical to imagine buying the potter's time. This fundamental shift in how we conceive of work and time has created a disconnect between human nature and modern employment practices, contributing to the psychological burden of bullshit jobs. This alienation is particularly acute in sectors where workers can't see the direct impact of their labor, such as financial services, corporate law, and administrative roles. Unlike traditional craftspeople or caregivers who can witness the immediate results of their efforts, many modern workers struggle to identify any tangible outcome from their daily activities. Why are bullshit jobs proliferating in an era supposedly devoted to efficiency and cost-cutting? This contradicts everything we're taught about how market economies function. The percentage of workers who consider their jobs pointless has been rapidly increasing, alongside the bullshitization of previously useful forms of employment, with recent surveys suggesting up to 40% of workers in developed economies question their job's value to society. This phenomenon has received little public attention because it contradicts our fundamental assumptions about how market economies should work. While state socialist regimes were known for creating bogus jobs as public policy, like the infamous elevator operators in Soviet buildings, the neoliberal era following the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 was supposed to usher in unprecedented efficiency and streamlined operations. Instead, the opposite happened, with bureaucratic layers multiplying across both private and public sectors. The case of American universities powerfully demonstrates this trend. Between 1985-2005, while tuition skyrocketed by over 300% adjusted for inflation, the number of teachers per student remained virtually constant, but administrative staff ballooned by 240% and administrators by 85%. This wasn't because teaching became more complex. Professors still give lectures, lead seminars, and grade papers much as they always have. New positions emerged with titles like Associate Dean of Student Life or Deputy Director of Strategic Initiatives, often with unclear responsibilities. Nor can government regulation be blamed, since private universities saw administrative growth at twice the rate of public ones, suggesting internal factors driving this expansion. The financial industry exemplifies how bullshit jobs can be intentionally maintained for profit. In the UK's Payment Protection Insurance, PPI scandal, major accountancy firms deliberately mistrained staff and constantly changed procedures to ensure work was done incorrectly, requiring cases to be redone and contracts extended. The cynicism was remarkable, with impossible targets that increased staff turnover, requiring more mistrained employees. Internal whistleblowers reported that managers openly discussed these tactics in meetings, viewing inefficiency as a revenue stream. This mirrors Charles Dickens's portrayal in Bleak House of lawyers deliberately prolonging cases until they've consumed entire estates in legal fees. The entire FIRE sector, finance, insurance, real estate, operates similarly, creating money through increasingly complex financial instruments, extracting fees with every transaction, and generating paperwork that requires armies of employees to process. Many bank employees report spending their days shuffling documents that could be handled automatically or completing reports that no one reads. The proliferation of middle management positions in these sectors often serves to justify high fees rather than add genuine value. The growth of bullshit jobs appears linked to what anthropologists call managerial feudalism, where organizations become increasingly hierarchical not out of necessity, but to provide titles and status positions that justify higher compensation at the top. This helps explain why even as technology makes many processes more efficient, organizations often become more, not less, bureaucratic. The proliferation of bullshit jobs reflects a fundamental transformation in capitalism that Graeber calls managerial feudalism. Like medieval lords, modern executives maintain bloated retinues as displays of power and means of distributing patronage. The crucial difference is that medieval production was self-regulated by skilled craftspeople who took pride in their work and maintained high standards through guilds, while today's workers face endless supervision from efficiency experts who paradoxically create inefficiency through excessive oversight and bureaucratic processes. The Elephant Tea Factory provides a striking example of this transformation. When workers successfully improved productivity by 50% through their own initiative and knowledge of the production process, management responded not by sharing the increased profits or investing in further improvements, but by hiring unnecessary white-collar staff. These new managers, with little understanding of tea production, eventually proposed outsourcing the entire operation, a move that would destroy the very efficiency gains that prompted their hiring. This pattern repeats across industries, where worker-driven improvements are often met with increased bureaucratic oversight rather than rewards. This reflects capitalism's broken promise. During the Golden Age from 1945 to 1975, productivity gains matched worker compensation, creating broad-based prosperity. However, since then, productivity has soared while wages remained essentially flat, adjusting for inflation. The excess profits now flow in two directions, upward to the 1% in the form of executive compensation and shareholder returns, and laterally to fund armies of pointless managerial positions arranged in elaborate hierarchies. These hierarchies create their own self-sustaining ecosystem of meetings, reports, and strategic initiatives that add little real value. Creative industries have been particularly transformed by managerial sub-infeudation, with hierarchies multiplying at every level like a bureaucratic virus. Academic editors, once focused on improving manuscript quality, now spend more time marketing to other editors and managing complex approval processes than reading the books they've supposedly edited. The art world has elevated curators to near-equal status with artists themselves, creating layers of intermediaries between art and audience. Journalism has inserted producers between reporters and editors, adding additional layers of oversight that often slow down rather than enhance news production. Hollywood's transformation exemplifies these worst excesses of managerial feudalism. The old studio system, where single decision-makers with artistic instincts ran vertical operations, has been replaced by corporate conglomerates staffed with MBA-wielding executives bearing elaborate titles like Executive Vice President of Creative Development or Senior Director of Project Strategy. These executives, who typically know little about actual filmmaking, spend their days writing emails, attending coordination meetings, and having power lunches with other executives. The development process has become a strategic ballet of endless meetings, vague feedback, and responsibility avoidance, where executives deliberately stall projects to justify their positions. This has led to a risk-averse culture where genuine creativity is stifled by layers of approval and market testing, resulting in an endless stream of sequels and remakes rather than original content. Our attitudes toward work are deeply rooted in theological concepts dating back to ancient religious texts. Work is paradoxically viewed as both punishment, stemming from the biblical expulsion from Eden, and divine creation, mirroring God's 6 days of world-making. This duality creates a complex psychological relationship where work is simultaneously something unpleasant we'd rather avoid, yet morally necessary for human dignity. This creates a perverse value system where anything enjoyable can't be considered real work deserving payment, a mindset that particularly impacts creative and caring professions. A disturbing consensus has emerged across the political spectrum that not working is morally reprehensible, with both liberals and conservatives condemning those who don't participate in traditional employment. Even the wealthy, who historically celebrated their freedom from labor, now pride themselves on workaholic schedules rather than leisure. Tech billionaires boast about 80-hour work weeks, while corporate leaders showcase their 4 a.m. workout routines as badges of virtue. This moral framework creates a bizarre inverse relationship between social value and compensation that defies economic logic. Extensive research confirms that medical researchers add $9 of social value for every one earned, while financial sector workers subtract $1.80 for every one paid. A comprehensive UK study found hospital cleaners generate 10 of social value per one earned, while city bankers destroy 7 of value per one earned. Similar patterns emerge across professions. Teachers, nurses, and social workers consistently generate more social value than their compensation reflects. Society seems to embrace the counterintuitive notion that those who benefit others shouldn't expect good compensation, while those suffering through harmful or meaningless work deserve higher pay precisely because their jobs are unpleasant or purposeless. This reflects a broader consensus that work itself is the primary value, regardless of its purpose or effects on society. The phenomenon manifests in everything from unpaid internships and beneficial fields to enormous bonuses for potentially destructive financial speculation. The labor theory of value dominated American thought through the late 19th century, with even frontier miners and cowboys reportedly engaging in sophisticated discussions about the socialistic theories of Karl Marx. This widespread understanding viewed labor as the source of all wealth. However, a calculated counteroffensive by America's emerging capitalist class successfully dismantled this common sense understanding. The robber barons, initially viewed with public hostility, launched what Andrew Carnegie called the Gospel of Wealth, a comprehensive ideological campaign arguing that capital, not labor, creates prosperity. This shift fundamentally altered American attitudes toward work, wealth, and worth, establishing the moral confusion that persists today. Our consumer society is built around compensatory consumerism, activities that can be squeezed into predictable time slots between work, like shopping or watching TV shows, rather than time-intensive social activities. This pattern has intensified with the rise of on-demand entertainment, mobile shopping apps, and social media, which provide instant gratification without requiring meaningful social engagement. Even leisure has become commodified, with experiences packaged into convenient time blocks that fit around work schedules. This creates a political landscape rife with resentment, fracturing society along multiple fault lines. The unemployed resent the employed for their economic security. The employed resent the scroungers, whom they perceive as living off their taxes. Those in bullshit jobs resent those doing meaningful work for their sense of purpose. And those doing meaningful but underpaid work resent the liberal elite who monopolize the few well-paid meaningful jobs. These resentments are amplified by media narratives and social media echo chambers that reinforce these divisions. Moral envy plays a crucial role, the resentment felt toward those upholding higher moral standards. This explains why auto workers and teachers face such hostility despite their socially valuable work. Their very commitment to meaningful labor and reasonable compensation becomes grounds for attack. For instance, when teachers strike for better working conditions, they're often portrayed as greedy rather than as advocates for education quality. Similarly, manufacturing workers seeking fair wages are criticized for threatening economic competitiveness. Right-wing populism exploits this dynamic masterfully, pitting working people against the liberal elite, coastal professionals who both look down on ordinary workers and constitute an increasingly closed caste that working-class children cannot penetrate. This manifests in everything from college admissions to hiring practices to social networks. Unlike wealth, which theoretically anyone might attain through luck or enterprise, cultural elite status has become effectively hereditary, passed down through educational opportunities, social connections, and cultural capital. Our society has reached a paradoxical impasse. technological advances could free us from drudgery, yet we've constructed a moral economy that treats this as catastrophic. Robotization threatens jobs, but our response isn't to celebrate potential liberation from toil, it's panic about unemployment. This reveals a fundamental contradiction in our economic system. We've achieved the productive capacity to reduce working hours dramatically, but our social structures and economic systems demand full employment. The result is the proliferation of unnecessary jobs and the intensification of status anxiety across all social classes. The politics of resentment has become self-reinforcing, as each group's grievances fuel political movements that often work against their own economic interests. This dynamic helps explain why many voters support policies that seem to contradict their material needs, choosing cultural alignment over economic benefit. There are competing visions of universal basic income, a conservative version that would replace welfare with modest stipends, and a radical version that would maintain existing guarantees like public health care while expanding unconditional support. As an anarchist, Graeber supports the latter, seeing it not as expanding state power, but reducing it by eliminating intrusive bureaucracies that morally surveil citizens. Basic income would free millions from pointless jobs while allowing them to pursue meaningful work or personal passions. Most importantly, it would give workers the power to say orange to their boss, the equivalent of a BDSM safe word in workplace power dynamics. This would transform the sadomasochistic nature of hierarchical work arrangements by allowing people to exit harmful situations without economic consequences. Jobs like Annie's at medical care cost management would likely disappear, as no one would choose to highlight forms in silence if their survival didn't depend on it. The health insurance bureaucracy itself might finally be reformed, as people would have time for political organizing instead of scrambling to pay bills through pointless work. The common objection that people won't work is demonstrably false, while the fear that people would pursue useless passions ignores that 37 to 40% of workers already consider their jobs pointless. If everyone could freely choose how to benefit humanity, how could the resulting labor distribution possibly be less efficient than our current system, where half the economy consists of or supports bullshit jobs? Automation didn't fail to eliminate jobs. It succeeded spectacularly. We've simply filled the gap with bullshit jobs. If we eliminated these positions and the real jobs that only exist to support them, 50 to 60% of the population has effectively been thrown out of meaningful work. Yet throughout human history, societies managed to distribute necessary tasks without forcing most people to spend their waking hours doing things they'd rather not do. The political economy of bullshit jobs represents a perfect system for maintaining the power of finance capital. Real productive workers are exploited while the remainder are split between the terrorized stratum of the unemployed and a larger group basically paid to do nothing in positions designed to align them with ruling class perspectives. This powerful argument for human freedom should prompt us to imagine what a genuinely free society might look like.